Welcome to Poems for Company. I'm your host, Brian Dillon. Each fall, I devote one show to poems responding to the First World War. The poetry that emerged from the First World War is, arguably, the most profound war-related poetry ever written. Why read these poems in the fall? The war ended at the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month of the year 1918, the day we mark as Veterans Day. On last year's episode, I featured poems presenting the civilians' response to the war. That episode, of course, is available in podcast. The poems I'll read today allow us to hear the voices of young men attempting to rationalize whether they should serve in the military. What's in it for them? What kind of peer pressure are they under to sign up? What do they see as the likely outcome if they do enlist? So I'm titling this episode, Why Serve? First World War Poems of Internal Conflicts. You will hear three very different attempts to answer the question, why serve? The Irish poet W.B. Yeats was in his 50s for most of the war, much too old to serve, even if he wanted to. But he knew secondhand how some of his fellow Irishmen were affected by the choice they faced to sign up for the British military. Ireland, during the 19-teens, continued to be colonized by Britain. The Republic of Ireland would not gain its independence until 4 years after the war ended, that is, in 1922. So there are political choices to be made by any Irishman at that time. Do I want to serve the political power that has subjugated my people? If I and others do enlist and prove our loyalty to Britain, might that speed up our goal of achieving independence? W.B. Yeats' poem, An Irish Airman Foresees His Death, allows us to hear the unspoken thoughts of a young aviator from the west of Ireland who is part of that brand new generation who took to the skies in the 19-teens. I wonder if this aviator had ever even seen an airplane fly over his family property before the war broke out. Flying, essentially, was just invented at this time. The speaker refers to Kiltartan Cross. That's a district in County Galway, in the west of Ireland. Let's hear Yeats' poem, An Irish Airman Foresees His Death. I know that I shall meet my fate somewhere among the clouds above. Those that I fight I do not hate. Those that I guard I do not love. My country is Kiltartan Cross. My countrymen Kiltartans poor. No likely end could bring them loss or leave them happier than before. Nor law nor duty bade me fight, nor public men nor cheering crowds. A lonely impulse of delight drove to this tumult in the clouds. I balanced all, brought all to mind. The years to come seemed waste of breath, a waste of breath the years behind, in balance with this life, this death. W.B. Yeats, An Irish Airman Foresees His Death. A poem so simply structured with four quatrains, 8 syllables per line, and an obvious rhyme scheme, fate, hate, above, not love, cross, loss, and so forth. Deceptively simple. The speaker expresses an almost suicidal outlook with this calm, detached style. Do you detect any anguish in his choice? The poem opens, I know that I shall meet my fate somewhere among the clouds above. He's resigned to dying even prior to takeoff. He accepts the extreme risk of dying even though he knows the cause he is supposed to be serving means nothing to him. He has no skin in this game. Those that I fight I do not hate. Those that I guard I do not love. As is typical of First World War poems, He refuses to be drawn into any political discussion. He can't be bothered to address Germany's wrongs or England's claims to righteous justice. He's attached to his immediate Galway locality, Kiltartan. His neighbors there are under no threats by German bombers, and the folks he knows there won't benefit from England's victory or suffer more if England is defeated. There's an absolute lack of rah-rah patriotism. Peer pressure did not affect him either. Then why sign up, especially when the likelihood of death in the skies is so high? The first generation aviator who speaks this poem feels a kind of aesthetic compulsion to leave this earth, ascend into a zone most everyone he has ever known has never entered. A lonely impulse of delight drove to this tumult in the clouds. Personal pleasure, so temporary as it will be, entices him to take off into the sky. The poem could have ended there on a somewhat upbeat note. Yet there's one more quatrain. Let's be alert to the final four lines when I reread the poem. Then I will briefly comment on the specific individual Yeats had in mind when reading this poem. Again, this is An Irish Airman Foresees His Death. I know that I shall meet my fate somewhere among the clouds above. Those that I fight, I do not hate. Those that I guard, I do not love. My country is Kiltartan Cross. My countrymen, Kiltartans poor. No likely end could bring them loss or leave them happier than before. Nor law nor duty bade me fight, nor public men nor cheering crowds. A lonely impulse of delight drove to this tumult in the clouds. I balanced all, brought all to mind. The years to come seemed waste of breath, a waste of breath the years behind, in balance with this life, this death. It's as though the young man, whose private unvoiced thoughts Yeats shares, chose a heightened, brief moment of ecstasy over a longer life of merely modest satisfactions. I balanced all, he says, past, present, and future. We are to accept that this man has weighed his choice, knows what he's doing. This poem is one of a number Yeats wrote memorializing Robert Gregory, the only child of his artistic collaborator and patroness, Lady Augusta Gregory. The poem was written in 1918, the same year Robert Gregory died. Most curiously, by friendly fire over the Italian front. As Yeats says elsewhere, this dead aviator was my dear friend's dear son, a soldier, scholar, horseman. Let's return to earth with a poem that embeds dialogue between a plowman at work in his fields and another young man, a stranger, who sits on a fallen elm in a fallow, a small section of land left unsown. This seated young man, the poem's main speaker, watches the plowman. They are strangers to each other. They speak to one another when the plowman reaches the end of his furrow, the groove his plow cuts, and pauses to wipe off his share, the blade of the plow. For a minute, the two men talk. Then the plowman resumes his work until he returns to the end of the furrow 10 minutes later. Their exchange starts with information about the fallen elm itself, then shifts to whether the seated young man should enlist. A few lines reference some curious movement in the background of this natural setting. This is Edward Thomas's poem, As the Team's Head Brass. The title also serves as the opening phrase and references decorative brass medallion on the harness of the horses pulling the plow. As the team's head brass flashed out on the turn, the lovers disappeared into the wood. I sat among the boughs of the fallen elm that strewed an angle of the fallow and watched the plow narrowing a yellow square of charlock. Every time the horses turned, instead of treading me down, the plowman leaned upon the handles to say or ask a word about the weather, next about the war. Scraping the share, he faced toward the wood and screwed along the furrow till the brass flashed once more. The blizzard felled the elm, whose crest I sat in, by a woodpecker's round hole, the plowman said. When will they take it away? When the war is over. So the talk began. 1 minute and an interval of 10. 1 minute more and the same interval. Have you been out? No. And don't want to, perhaps. If I could only come back again, I should. I could spare an arm. I shouldn't want to lose a leg. If I should lose my head, why, so, I should want nothing more. Have many gone from here? Yes. Many lost? Yes, good few. Only 2 teams work on the farm this year. One of my mates is dead. The second day in France, they killed him. It was back in March, the very night of the blizzard, too. Now, if he had stayed here, we should have moved the tree. And I should not have sat here. Everything would have been different, for it would have been another world. Aye, and a better, though if we could see all might seem good. Then the lovers came out of the wood again. The horses started, and for the last time I watched the clods crumble and topple over after the plowshare and the stumbling team. That's Edward Thomas's As the Team's Head Brass. The plowman avoids judging the speaker about whether he should enlist. During his inquiry of the stranger, the plowman's tone is gentle, not confrontational. The plowman lost a mate in France. If that mate had not enlisted, he would have assisted in moving the very elm the stranger sits on. So this plowman understands on a most personal level the serious dangers any young man faces who puts on a uniform and crosses the English Channel to the Western Front. It's always valuable to note what a poem does not say that we might have expected it to say. The plowman says absolutely nothing about a political justification for the war. Nor does the speaker raise any concerns about patriotic motives for fighting, nor even any peer pressure on him to enlist. The speaker says if he could foresee his future, he might enlist. He does not want to die, of course, nor lose a leg. He says, I could spare an arm. Imagine the calculations involved in reaching that conclusion. I could spare an arm. The plowman turns philosophical. Would it be a better world if the war never erupted? The plowman voices the final line of the dialogue, though not the final line of the poem. If we could see all might seem good. The stranger sitting on the fallen elm does not indicate whether he shares this tentatively optimistic outlook. The poem was written in May of 1916, over a year after the author, Edward Thomas, himself enlisted. He had no interest, no reason to be optimistic. I've referred to the speaker as a stranger. How do we know that? He asked the plowman. Have many gone from here? If he were a local boy, he'd know. Let's hear it once more as the team's head brass by Edward Thomas. As the team's head brass flashed out on the turn, the lovers disappeared into the wood. I sat among the boughs of the fallen elm that strewed an angle of the fallow and watched the plow narrowing a yellow square of charlock. Every time the horses turned, instead of treading me down, the plowman leaned upon the handles to say or ask a word about the weather, next about the war. Scraping the share, he faced toward the wood and screwed along the furrow till the brass flashed once more. The blizzard felled the elm, whose crest I sat in, by a woodpecker's round hole, the plowman said. When will they take it away? When the war's over. So the talk began. 1 minute and an interval of 10. A minute more and the same interval. Have you been out? No. And don't want to, perhaps. If I could only come back again, I should. I could spare an arm. I shouldn't want to lose a leg. If I should lose my head, why, so, I should want nothing more. Have many gone from here? Yes. Many lost? Yes, good few. Only 2 teams work on the farm this year. One of my mates is dead. The second day in France, they killed him. It was back in March, the very night of the blizzard, too. Now, if he had stayed here, we should have moved the tree. And I should not have sat here. Everything would have been different, for it would have been another world. Aye, and a better, though if we could see all might seem good. Then the lovers came out of the wood again. The horses started, and for the last time I watched the clods crumble and topple over after the plowshare and the stumbling team. Edward Thomas's poem, As the Team's Head Brass. Let's consider the poem's 2 mystery lines. The lovers disappeared into the wood. That's the second line of the poem. Then in line 33 of this 36-line poem, the speaker notes, the lovers came out of the wood again. The speaker does not speculate on who this couple might be, nor does he express either envy or disapproval that lovers enter a wood for the duration of his conversation with the plowman. How does he even know they're lovers? His language implies he thinks the woods are the site of the couple's secret rendezvous. If the plowman recognizes the couple as locals, he's discreet, says nothing. But it's just as likely, focused as he is on his furrows and the stranger, he does not see them. Is the man in this couple due to be sent away in the military in a day or two and sharing final moments of intimacy just out of the sight range of the speaker? Well, I'm speculating. It's most curious that the speaker, the man sitting on the fallen elm, avoids doing so. In Yeats' Airman poem, the speaker admits that no law or duty pressed him to enlist, nor public men, nor cheering crowds, as the poem says. The speaker in Edward Thomas's poem does not refer to peer pressure either. But the situation was totally different for many young British men who felt the weight of peer pressure amid an upswelling of patriotic drum beating provided mainly by adult men in their schools, churches, and elsewhere in their villages. This kind of enthusiastic pressure motivated the very young man who is the subject of Wilfred Owen's poem, Disabled. Owen presents a wheelchair-bound man who has lost both legs and one arm. His chair is positioned outside of the institution where he lives. It's dusk. And this young man recalls what his life was like just a year ago. His thoughts switch rapidly from fond memories of when he was healthy and handsome to unpleasant reminders of his current circumstances. I don't think you will find the poem jumpy. Owen finished this poem just months before the war ended in 1918, just months before Owen himself, an officer, was killed in combat in the war's final week. This is Wilfred Owen's Disabled. He sat in a wheeled chair, waiting for dark, and shivered in his ghastly suit of gray, legless, sewn short at elbow. Through the park, voices of boys rang saddening like a hymn, voices of play and pleasure after day, till gathering sleep had mothered them from him. About this time, town used to swing so gay when glow lamps budded in the light blue trees, and girls glanced lovelier as the air grew dim in the old times before he threw away his knees. Now he will never feel again how slim girls' waists are, or how warm their subtle hands. All of them touch him like some queer disease. There was an artist silly for his face, for it was younger than his youth last year. Now he is old. His back will never brace. He's lost his color very far from here, poured it down shell holes till the veins ran dry, and half his lifetime lapsed in the hot race and leap of purple spurted from his thigh. One time, he liked a blood smear down his leg. After the matches, carried shoulder high. It was after football. When he drunk a peg, he thought he'd better join. He wonders why. Someone had said he'd look a god in kilts. That's why. It may be, too, to please his Meg. Aye, that was it. To please the giddy jilts, he asked to join. He didn't have to beg. Smiling, they wrote his lie, aged 19 years. Germans he scarcely thought of, and no fears of fear came yet. He thought of jeweled hilts for daggers in plaid socks, of smart salutes, and care of arms, and leave, and pay arrears, esprit de corps, and hints for young recruits. And soon he was drafted out with drums and cheers. Some cheered him home, but not as crowds cheer goal. Only a solemn man who brought him fruits thanked him and then inquired about his soul. Now he will spend a few sick years in institutes and do what things the rules consider wise and take whatever pity they may dole. Tonight he noticed how the women's eyes passed from him to the strong men that were whole. How cold and late it is. Why don't they come and put him into bed? Why don't they come? Wilfred Owen's Disabled. He hears boys playing in the distance. He realizes no potential romantic life awaits him. Girls used to glance lovelier as the air grew dim. He used to put his arm around their waist and hold their warm hands. Now, all of them touch him like some queer disease. Legless, missing one arm, he knows he's not even a shell of the boy man he was a mere year ago. The final stanza notes, tonight he noticed how the women's eyes passed from him to the strong men that were whole. And when he answers this episode's central question, why serve, he admits he wanted to hold the attention of young women, be the kind of young man they would desire. He offers a variety of other explanations for enlisting, all of which sound exactly like motives appealing to a 16 or 17-year-old boy. Owen asserts the boy was swept up in the peer pressure of enlisting after a football match and a peg, a stiff drink. He wanted to please girls, thought he'd look smart in uniform, and the pay, the arrears, would help out at home. I'll reread a key stanza. One time he liked a blood smear down his leg, after the matches, carried shoulder high. It was after football when he drunk a peg. He thought he'd better join. He wonders why. Someone had said he'd look a god in kilts. That's why. It may be too to please his Meg. Aye, that was it. To please the giddy jilts, he asked to join. He didn't have to beg. Smiling, they wrote his lie. Age 19 years. Germans he scarcely thought of, and no fears of fear came yet. He thought of jeweled hilts for daggers in plaid socks, of smart salutes and care of arms and leave and pay arrears, esprit de corps and hints for young recruits, and soon he was drafted out with drums and cheers. Like Yates' aviator and Thomas's young man on the log, no political or moral concerns direct the choice to enlist. The poem does not editorialize. It does not need to. The wheelchair-bound man must recognize how incredibly shallow his motives were, though we can understand they would be enough to prompt a teen boy to enlist. The recruiter did not bother to check how old he really was. The British military, years into the war, was desperate for more soldiers at the front. Today's episode offers just a sampling of the thoughts of some young men about why they enlisted in the First World War. This show is now available on Spotify and Pandora and other podcast apps. Search the show name or KMUN and it should appear. Our theme music is Philip Auberg's Going to the Sun from a CD Live from Montana, available at sweetgrassmusic.com. Thanks for listening.